Welcome to the final seminar in the series on complexity and systemic risk. I'm slightly surprised that we're already at the end of the series. If you recall the beginning, we started by looking at what ecology might have to say to banking and financial stability with Robert May's talk. In between, we looked at everything from oceans to cities to the spread of infectious diseases. And in some sense, we've now come full circle, and we're back in thinking about ecosystems and ecosystems collapse. I'm extremely pleased to welcome Owen Petschy as the final speaker in this series from the University of Sheffield, whom Charles Godfrey described to me as one of the rising stars of ecology, and who is probably very well known for his work on foraging theory, but also on biodiversity, and who will be talking on contagious extinctions and ecosystems collapse. So a suitably dramatic topic to end the series with. Over to you.
Thanks very much, Felix. Thank you for coming along to listen. Thank you for the invitation to speak. It's a great pleasure to be here in Oxford and have the opportunity to speak. I'm going to be talking about The data I'm going to be talking about came from jars just like this and some work that a PhD student did. The questions that I'm going to be addressing with such a small system are really very wide-ranging. And they're all about what kind of gain is going on in ecosystems. So is it this type of gain? Is it this type of gain? Or is it this type of gain? All these games have something in common, and that's that they contain individual components that interact with each other. And in each of these games, the idea is to remove one of those components and to either cause very little change in what remains. And in each of these games, either it gets harder or easier to remove components as components are removed. And as we go on, I'm going to refer back to these games and try and answer what kind of ecological game is going on. It is particularly relevant that I speak about biodiversity for various reasons. Lord May, who gave the first lecture, as Felix said, has done a great deal of research and is kind of one of the fathers of theory on relationships between complexity and stability. Why ecosystems may not be stable, why they might collapse. Another reason is it's the International Year of Biodiversity this year, so we should be particularly focused on loss of biodiversity, the extinctions that are going on at the moment. And we should be interested in that because of the services that biodiversity provide us with, the services that biodiversity provide to humans that really give us some high levels of human well-being. And the last reason is because I believe the James Martin School is about to set up an Institute of Biodiversity. So it seems relevant that I talk about biodiversity, extinctions, and ecosystems. So one of the most remarkable things about life is that 99.9% of it is extinct. There are two examples, ammonites. You might have found them yourself looking on beaches, found those fossils yourself. You're less likely to have found one of these on the beach. It's Microraptor, which was recently discovered and was this strange dinosaur bird cross. But the unique thing about it was that it had four wings. So feathers on its forelimbs and also feathers on its hind limbs. And the vast majority of life shared the same fate as these two species, 99.9% extinct. And that led David Rao and other people suggest that we really need to understand extinctions to understand the history of biodiversity. Here is a graph of how biodiversity has changed over the last 600 million years, so from 600 million in the past to the present on the right. And there's been a gradual increase through time. But that increase, as I'm sure you're all aware, has been punctuated by these mass extinction events. I've highlighted just two of them, one at the end of the Permian, and then the much more reported one and investigated one at the end of the Cretaceous, when the dinosaurs went extinct. So this perspective, and supposedly these were caused by meteor impacts, external impacts causing extinctions. And these mass extinctions, and thinking about them, really gives us the idea that extinctions within a community, or extinctions on Earth, are caused by environmental effects. They're driven by changes in the environment, external effects on communities. This is the same data, more or less the same data, but with the x-axis flipped round. So it goes from about 600 million years in the past to the present here. The black line and the green line are the actual observed data, so there's a gradual increase through time. And what the authors of this paper did was they fit a general input, but they fit this blue line to the data and then look to see what the deviations around that blue line looked like. And this is, if you like, the residuals around the blue line. And you can see there's actually a 62 million year cycle that's going on in biodiversity. If they then look at the residuals around this blue line, they found that there was an even longer period cycle in biodiversity that's going on. So as well as this broad increase in biodiversity, there's a couple of kind of superimposed cycles that are going on there. And they talked about the possible explanations for this, or possible causes for these cycles. And it varies from differences in sedimentation rates, because this is from fossil data. So if there's differences or cycles in the rate at which sediments are laid down, that could cause these results. It could also result from long-term changes in how frequently the Earth is hit by extraterrestrial objects. That was another hypothesis they put forward. Another one, and a very different one, is that, well, these are communities and ecosystems of species and individuals that interact with each other. They're complex systems. They're also evolving systems. And perhaps this cycling is produced by the internal dynamics of the system. It's actually nothing to do with the environment hitting those species, but it's the internal dynamics of the system. And that is a perspective, or whole field of research. And I'm just going to run through a few examples of the kind of questions that have been covered in that field of research that really focuses on the internal dynamics of the system and how that determines biodiversity and whether extinctions occur. That's a picture of a food web. I know it's not particularly clear. It's a food web that actually we built once and put in these jars. And the species there are connected by trophic interactions. They feed upon each other. And when one builds models of that type of community, species that feed upon each other, we find that the stability of those systems is related to how many species there are and how many links there are between species. This is the work that Lord May did back in the late 70s, and still people are publishing papers based looking at the stability and complexity of systems. So there's an enormous field of research in ecology that concerns diversity and stability relationships. And that's focused at the community level, internal dynamics of the system, what people are focusing on. There's also a field of research in community ecology, if you like, that asks the question of, when a species goes extinct, does it cause further extinctions of other species? Does it cause a cascade of extinctions, a cascade of secondary extinctions? And this is an article in Science, and this is where I got the idea of Jenga, or Jenga. And here they talk about the idea of pulling out a block being an extinction, and perhaps then the community collapses because there are further extinctions caused by the instabilities introduced by that first extinction. So there's internal instabilities that are causing the dynamics. And the sea otter here is a prime example of how loss of a species can cause a cascade of extinctions. Sea otter on the Pacific coast of North America, it grazes on sea urchins. And the sea urchins graze the giant kelp. So when the sea otter is present, there is very few sea urchins because they're being eaten by the sea otters, and therefore quite a lot of giant kelp. When the sea otters went locally extinct, that allowed the sea urchins to grow up a lot. They ate all of the giant kelp. Actually, they prevented the giant kelp from recruiting. And that fundamentally changed the ecosystem. Many species went extinct as a result of that one species going extinct. And there's been a lot of research, theoretical research, about what causes secondary extinctions, when one might get lots of secondary extinctions and when one might get fewer. This community perspective on extinctions also includes concepts like robustness and resilience. Resilience is an idea about when an ecosystem is pushed, when an environment changes and pushes an ecosystem in a particular direction, it might flip into a different state. This is a diagram of how that can happen. Coral reefs are actually a prime example of a system that, if it's pushed too far, it flips into a different state. And coral reefs flip between being dominated by algae and being dominated by coral. And there's a positive feedback that goes on there. So when they're in the algal state, it's very difficult to push them into the coralline state, and the same are going the other way. And so these feedbacks within the system really determine how that behaves. Last of all, in this community kind of context, we can think about the consequences of extinctions. It's a slightly different subject. What happens when species go extinct to these ecosystem functions? So in this particular marine benthic community, this community at the bottom of the sea, people are really interested in nutrient cycling, how fast nutrients cycle out of the sediment into the water above. And the researchers here simulated extinctions and looked at the negative consequences for this nutrient cycling, or bioturbation. So that's the whole community and ecosystem perspective on extinctions. We're also interested in a different perspective, and that's driven by the fact that actually it's species that are going extinct, and we care about the species that are going extinct. Here are two examples. I'm sure you would know about the dodo. This was caused, the extinction of the dodo was caused because we ate them all. This species is the Yangtze River dolphin, and this holds the honour of being the first cetacean to go extinct as a result of human activities. Actually, we think it's extinct, but we're not quite sure. In 2006 was the last survey for this species, and no individuals were found. It's actually quite difficult to say when a species is definitely extinct. Because every now and again there's a report of someone having seen one, but it's not substantiated, and there have been reports of it being seen. But it seems quite likely that that species is extinct. Of course, these aren't the only two species that have been threatened with extinction. There are thousands of vertebrates, invertebrates and plants that are classified as threatened by the IUCN. They're on the red list. There appear to be very few lichen, mushrooms and algae, but that's almost certainly because people are somewhat less enthusiastic about studying those taxonomic groups than the others. So we just have less information about those types of species. Here is a graph from the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment, and it shows extinctions per 1,000 species per millennium, so on the y-axis, a measure of extinction rate. And one Well, between 0.1 and 1 is the extinction rate estimated from the fossil record. That's past extinction rates. This is the extinction rate that's estimated at the moment, about 1,000 times higher. And in the future, it might be 10 times higher again. So there's really a lot of concern about what will happen to biodiversity in the future. And also, as I said before, if we want to understand the history of biodiversity on Earth, we really need to take into account extinctions and understand extinctions. If you didn't see this programme on the BBC, then please try... Well, I would advise you to get hold of a copy of it from somewhere. It was fantastic. So 20 years ago, Stephen Fry and Mark Carwardine and Douglas Adams travelled the world to find some species that were on the edge of extinction. And I guess just last year or the year before, Stephen Fry and Mark Carwardine repeated that trip. And there's some extremely funny scenes in this series, and also some extremely moving scenes where they really do kind of make us wonder about letting or even making species go extinct. And I think this is kind of a positive reflection of people caring about extinctions. They do care about biodiversity. Millions of people watch this. And just to think about some of the ecological research that has been done at this kind of focused on the individual species. It's really focused on how the environment affects individual species and the characteristics of the species. And here are a few examples coming up that kind of describe the when, where, and who of who will go extinct. So the first example is population viability analysis. This is a mathematical technique. We're trying to figure out what's the probability of a species going extinct given a certain time in the future, and perhaps some other variable like the size of reserve that is given to the elephants. And so one can make a calculation about the extinction probability of that individual species given the environment that it lives in. We can ask questions about where species are likely to go extinct. That's the red here. And actually where they're likely to colonise. And there's been a huge amount of investment of resources into making these predictions. Some people call them climate envelope predictions, because as the climate changes and moves, that's what's actually causing these changes in the distribution of the species. And so this is very much a perspective on extinctions, where the species is affected by the environment, and then that's modulated by the species characteristics. Another example is of these species characteristics is that we might be, or people are interested in, what are the characteristics of species that are correlated with high extinction risk or low extinction risk? And it's been well documented for birds, go from the wren to much larger birds, that the larger birds suffer greater threat of extinction than smaller birds. There's quite a lot of potential reasons that might be that I'm not going to go into now. And all of this information about individual species and how they respond to the environment and how their environment is likely to change have been put together into the IUCN Red List that I talked about previously, and used to quantify the species threat level, threat of extinction. So far, I've kind of introduced these two perspectives on extinction. And they're actually really quite separate in the field of ecology. People do this kind of work, or they do this kind of work on extinction. So they look at how communities collapse, or they look at individual species and figure out how they're going to go, how they go extinct. And it's a bit like taking this kind of perspective on cars and the parts of cars. This perspective on species extinctions is like taking individual components from the car and figuring out, well, how long is that going to last in isolation? If we put it on the machine that tests that individual component, how long would it last? When is it likely to fail? Whereas this perspective takes the view of, well, when we have all the components together, working together and interacting, how long is it before the car fails? And how quickly does the car fail? And why does the car fail? So that's just a way of thinking about those two different perspectives. Not to say that there hasn't been some linkage between the two perspectives. One can use information about which species are most likely to go extinct, these risk correlates, to inform studies of the consequences of collapse. Some of the work that I've done previously shows that if species go extinct in order of decreasing body size, so the largest species first, it can cause greater, it has greater consequences for ecosystem processes than if species go extinct in random order. So there's a link there. And there's also a link going the other way. So if we look at the if we do a theoretical model and look at the species that suffer secondary extinction, they have particular characteristics. And so we can use these types of models of loss of species from communities to inform about risk correlates. But generally, there's really very little work that connects these two perspectives up. Very little work in this kind of gap here, if you like. And what I'm going to talk about now is, do we really need to understand extinction of individual species in the community context? And what do we gain from trying to understand species extinctions, taking into account both of these perspectives? And, of course, how can we find out if it's important or not? And one of the problems there is that studying extinctions is difficult. There are a few different ways that one can go about studying extinctions. You can study the fossil record. In that situation, we get those kind of graphs of change in biodiversity that I showed before. One can look to see whether those changes in biodiversity are related to changes in the environment. It's difficult, however, to draw causative or causal conclusions from that. We can't prove based on correlations what has actually caused events. Another way is what I talked about a little bit, looking at which species are most threatened today and if they share particular attributes in common, and if the species that are not threatened also share particular attributes in common. So that's looking at correlates of extinction risk. Another thing we can do is make theoretical models. And there's been a huge amount of work building theoretical models of communities and looking at extinctions within those communities. What I'm going to talk about is another way to look at extinctions, and this is it. It's what I've worked on since I did my PhD at Imperial College at Silwood Park. There I learned how to use these microbial microcosms, we call them, microbial small worlds, model ecosystems to study ecology and communities and ecosystems. And ever since then, that was back in... I graduated from my PhD in 97. So for about 13 years, I've been working with this model system. I do also do a lot of other different work. And actually, I shouldn't really say that I work with this model system now, because it's quite a long time since I looked down a microscope and counted these organisms. It's mostly graduate students now who do that. And the work that I'm going to talk about is... the experiment that I'm going to talk about is the work of a graduate student. So in these is some nutrient media. It's just plant matter and some water, basically distilled water with a few salts. We put this in the autoclave, so it is sterile to start with. We then add some bacteria, and that forms the base of the food web. I'm going a little bit out of order. And we assemble a bunch of these, just like here, and just like there. This is an experiment that some third year undergraduates did. And this is a really great teaching tool for undergraduates because the organisms reproduce so fast that in about about 6 weeks, a whole experiment can be done. So in one semester, undergraduates can design, set up, observe, and then analyse their experiments. So they get a lot out of working with this system. In each of those jars is a food web. So there are the nutrients, the plant nutrients. We put in some bacteria after we've autoclaved it. And ciliates, protists, feed upon those bacteria. So like paramecium is a classic ciliate that feeds on these bacteria. Now we can also put in predators. So we can actually make a food chain or a food web in each of these jars. Looking down a microscope, we can observe how many individuals of each species there are, and through time record changes in population size. So this is abundance through time for a predator-prey pair. The prey starts off at high density, and then we introduce the predator, which gradually grows up and eats all of the prey. The prey don't go extinct here for some chance reason. The predators decrease because there's very few prey around, and the prey grow back up. So we can actually see, we've seen here an extinction. So in this community, because things eat each other so fast and die so fast and grow so fast, we can observe extinctions in very short amounts of time. So this is actually a reasonably good system for studying extinctions. We can make quite complex communities in this jar. This is the kind of full community. If we put every species together that we've got in our kind of lab zoo, this would be the food web that would be formed. So there is this is actually light here. Basal resource is light because we can use algae in these jars. This is the plant matter which bacteria grow upon. And these are the top predators up at the top here. So that's the food web. Just after I finished my PhD, I went to work in New Jersey at Rutgers University in New Brunswick. Pleasure of living in New Jersey. It was actually lovely. I very much enjoyed it. And while I was there, I did an experiment with my boss at the time, Peter Morin, where we set up a bunch of these communities and put half of them in a constant temperature and half of them in slowly increasing temperature. So this is an experiment where we were asking about the consequences of gradual warming on these communities. Peter, my boss, he counted bacteria. He looked to see how a number of bacteria were affected. Tim Casey measured gas flux, CO2 flux, which is a measure of community respiration. Timon measured decomposition rate, and I guarded the jars. And I was a lot younger then. I can't quite see, but I was. All I'm going to talk about now is this result from that experiment. These are the four trophic levels, or four trophic groups of the species in those jars. Producers, so algae, species that ate bacteria, species that ate the algae, and species that ate the species that ate the algae. And there were many more extinctions in the warmed environment. So gradually warming caused a lot of extinctions. So they were really focused on the higher trophic levels, the herbivores and the predators. So this really changed the shape of the food web, and there's a whole story about that that's in the publication that's associated with this. The question that this raised that I'd never been able to answer, and I've still not really answered it, is, were these extra extinctions caused by direct effects of the environment, so warming, so the predators and herbivores might have just been more sensitive to temperature, so direct effects of the environment on the individual species, or were these extra extinctions caused because of the internal dynamics of the system? Was it the species perspective that could explain these results, or was it the community perspective that could explain the results? Ecology or environment, you might call it. Direct effects of the physical environment on the species, or interspecific interactions and changes in those interactions. And perhaps that causes... one extinction to have an effect that propagates through the food webs, through the food webs. Kind of the same way as if you imagine, well, when you throw a pebble into a pond, you get the ripples that go outwards. Perhaps the environment pushes one of these species and makes it go extinct, and then the effects of that spread out through the food web. Okay, this is where it gets a tiny bit kind of technical. So I don't know, I was told to keep it general. So this is the bit where it does get a tiny bit more technical. I'm going to tell you about the results of this experiment. So in order to analyse the experiment, or figure out what we wanted to do next, we set up three hypotheses. And the kind of thing that we were interested in, the response variable, we made species extinction times. So we're interested in species extinction time. That's the response variable. That's what we're going to put on the y-axis of the graph, if you like. And the first hypothesis is that species extinction time depends only on the identity of the species. Second hypothesis is that the environmental conditions have some effect on species extinction time. So in a warm environment, maybe the extinction time is faster than in a cool environment. There can also be differences between species here. And the last hypothesis is that species extinction times depend on their identity, on environmental conditions, and on the community they exist in, other species. So there are hypotheses, and we want to test them with an experiment. This is where this system comes into its own. So we did an experiment on extinction dynamics. This is done by the PhD student, Nick Worsfold. He set up 200 communities, each with 17 species, two temperatures, and two energy levels. 50 replicates of each of those four combinations. 50 replicates of the four combinations gives the 200 communities. 17 species in each of the 200 communities give to 3,400 populations that he tracked through 8 weeks. He nearly went crazy. Actually, I think he did, but he got better, so that's okay. And each of these souffle dishes this time, you don't have to keep them in jars like this, you can keep them in souffle dishes as well. He put under a microscope once a day for a week, each week, and looked to see if the species that he put in at the beginning were present or absent. And so that gives this kind of data on it. We start at 17 species, and there were actually a lot of extinctions that happened. So we put we put 17 in because that's how many species we had in the lab at the time. So we just threw everything in together and just looked to see how many species went extinct, but really who went extinct and when they went extinct. So the data is actually much richer than is represented in this graph. Actually, this is how rich the data is that Nick collected in the experiment. So this is the Blepharisma, the rosy protist. It's the pink protist. And this is the extinction time distribution of that species in the low temperature environment, black bars, and the high temperature environment. In the low temperature, the most frequent, the largest number of extinctions happen in week 4 and week 5. In the high temperature environment, the largest number of extinctions occur in week 2 and 3. So you can immediately see that this distribution of extinction times in the low temperature has been shifted towards earlier extinction. So there's a strong environmental effect on extinction times caused in this experiment. This is when we look at an individual species. This suggests that hypothesis 2 is going to be better than hypothesis 1. Hypothesis 1 was that there was no such effect. This is, I know, completely incomprehensible. for you. It's just to show the 17 species and each of the extinction time distributions for those species. This is what we looked at before, Blepharisma. Some of them, species never go extinct. That's what it means when there's all these dashes right at the end here. None of those species went extinct. And this is one of the species where all of the populations of this species went extinct before the first time Nick sampled. So we can't really do any analyses on these species. There's no variation to analyse. But for all of the other species, we set up a mathematical model, a statistical model, that corresponded to each of these hypotheses, and looked to see how well that mathematical model that could explain the observed variation in extinction time. This is hypothesis one model. There are only differences between extinction times of species. There's no environmental effect, there's no effect of interactions between species. So this is observed extinction time versus predicted extinction time. So if this is a really good model, you expect to see all of the points lying along the one-to-one line, which is shown there. And 23% there indicates the amount of variability that the model explains. It's not a great model. 23% actually isn't bad for ecology, but it's not that good here. And you can see that there's not really a good sign that they lie along the one-to-one line. So that's species differences only. If we add in to the model differences between the effects of the environment on extinction times, well, there's a massive increase in the variance explained, up to 70%. And it does look like they lie more on the one-to-one line. They're closer to the one-to-one line than in this situation. So we can conclude from that environmental effects are really important for determining the time when species go extinct in these communities. When we add interspecific differences into the... When we add biotic interactions into the model, so this is hypothesis 3 model, we go up to 92%. So there's added explanatory power by putting in the biotic interactions. And here we can see that we're really getting quite a nice relationship between predicted and observed. Think about this in another way. We can plot the prediction error. That's what this is on the y-axis, prediction error, for each of the three different types of model or hypothesis. So there's higher prediction error when we only include differences between species, lower prediction error when there's also environmental effects, and lowest when we include biotic interactions as well. So the conclusions from this are we really have to understand both environmental effects and effects of biotic interactions. We have to include the community context in which species exist to understand extinctions. There's actually quite a lot of variability between species here, but I think I'm kind of running over time a little bit, so I'll leave that for afterwards. So I believe there's time for discussion afterwards. So community context can be useful for explaining species extinctions. We really need to link together these two perspectives to best understand when a species goes extinct. If you like, we know that the game that's going on in these communities is a game where components interact with each other. Removing a component will have some kind of effect on the other components. We know it's some kind of game like this, but we don't know what the rules of the game are, given those previous analyses. So is it like a plum, Jenga, or pickup sticks? What is the type of game that's going on here? That's like asking the question, what are the effects of... What are those biotic interactions? What are their effects? Are they stabilising or destabilising? Does the game get harder or easier as species are lost? And then also, why? What is it that's causing these effects of one species on another? In order to try and understand or answer those two questions, we make a table of the effect that the extinction of one species has on the extinction time of another species. So, here, the minus 2.8 shows the effect of species F going extinct on the extinction time of species D. So if F goes extinct, D goes extinct 2.8 weeks earlier than it would have otherwise. And we can fill this table in. These numbers actually come directly from the mathematical model that's estimated from the data that we collected in the experiment. And we can fill this entire table in from that data. And this is what we find, that the table is dominated by negative effects. Loss of one species speeds up the extinction of other species. And that's why I use the term contagious extinctions in the title of the talk, because there's this kind of contagion that spreads through the community. There are very few positive effects. Now, you remember the experiment lasted 8 weeks, and there's plus 15 and minus 15.9 there. That's something that you might like to ask about afterwards. I'll not go over it right now. So, destabilizing. This is a game that gets harder as species are lost. That's the type of the game. And there's the why. Well, this is the same table showing all those kind of interspecific effects of one species on another. And the other piece of information that we have about effects of one species on another is the food web for this community. So bacteria, nanoflagellates, paramecium eats the bacteria, didinium eats the paramecium. And so we have this information about direct interactions. And the question now is, do these match up? Do the direct interactions here explain the presence of the effects that we see of one species extinction on another species extinction? And when we plot the graph, we get no relationship at all. So it seems like these direct trophic interactions are not explaining the extinction effects. There are different ways of making this graph. Here we've got the sign of the direct trophic interaction on the x-axis, so the food web information on the x-axis, and we've got the extinction information on the y-axis. There's different things that we can put on these axes, but everything that I've looked at does not have a very good relationship there. And what that suggests is that there must be some other kind of interactions that are causing the effects. Indirect interactions, perhaps mediated through a third species. It could also be there's non-trophic interactions that are causing these effects of the extinction of one species on another. Maybe there's changes in bacterial composition. Bacteria were a single box down here, but there's many species of bacteria. Maybe there's evolution going on. Andrew Gonzalez, who did his PhD with me at Silwood, has just published with Graham Bell a really nice paper that shows how populations can be rescued from extinction by evolution. And none of the models that we've looked at yet include evolution. So this is the game that's going on in these jars, at least. This is the ecological game. It's one where loss of components increases the risk of failure of the remaining components due to the complex network of interactions among those components, indirect interactions. We've taken a species, we're interested in species extinctions when species go extinct, and really we've shown we gain a lot from taking into account community context. So linking these together got us up to 92% of the variability in extinction time explained, and that's an extraordinarily high amount of variability explained. When I wrote the talk, I realised I wasn't actually going to have much time to talk about the second part of the title, which was ecosystem collapse. Ecosystem collapse, that's what this graph is. That's this part of the experiment, or that's this data, and where species richness declines throughout the experiment. There's really interesting effects going on here. So the different environment treatments are indicated by the different lines. They end up in different places. Maybe that's not surprising. Maybe it is interesting. One of the really interesting things is that the lines cross. So you can lose species very quickly, but then less quickly. And what I'd like to do next, or actually what I have some funding to do now, is employ someone to figure out how those effects of one extinction on the extinction of another species translate into these kind of patterns of ecosystem collapse. So again, to link the species perspective and the community perspective. So that's all of the ecology, and I think what that hopefully shows is that we really do need to put together that species level and community level research, and we can gain a lot from doing that. We can gain both in terms of what we understand about species extinctions, but also what we understand about community collapse. There's lots of other types of network. It's really interesting talking with Felix about different types of networks. The network of organs, the internet, financial networks and social networks. Here's the rail network, which today I didn't discover the dynamics of how this operates when components fail, but on Saturday morning, Trent Junction failed and it was chaos. So all of these kind of share in common the idea that actually we're both interested in how individual components function and fail, but also how the network as a whole behaves. We really need to link together individual behaviour and network community behaviour to understand that. I guess someone's recognised that, at least in terms of the rail network. This is an EPSRC funding call that's just come out. It's called Railway Capacity, Overcoming the Constraints Caused by Nodes on the Rail Network. So how can we make the rail network more reliable by changing behaviour of the nodes? I just want to remind you again that it's this International Year of Biodiversity. Biodiversity is life. Biodiversity is our life. And I hope that if you see any opportunities to take part in events that recognise the International Year of Biodiversity, that you do so. Finally, there are lots of people who contributed towards this work and some of the work that's built up to it. In particular, the first person, Nick Worsfold, who actually carried out the experiment. And there have been various people who funded me and agencies who funded me in the research. That's all I'm going to say. Thank you very much for your attention. Thanks.